In the sections that we're going to read today, Paul quotes the passage, "The earth is the Lord's," and I thought I would read you James Carroll's little poem today called "The Lord's is the Earth." I'm reminded of the fact that in the Old Testament, the vision at least was that the people did not own the land. The land was the Lord's. He gave it. And the reminder of that was that every 50 years they were just to give the land back again to every tribe and family that originally owned it, so that nobody ever could take possession of the land. But this is Carroll's poem. "The Lord's is the earth and the fullness thereof. Perhaps. I do know it's not mine. I wander out beyond the last outpost of our easy time together, past fields oozing corn, past a dead leaf curling, past a ditch of closed flowers, past a fox dragging his paw. I come to the bare bough where last April a bird sang, and I began my low humming. I cling to it again, and I know that this earth owns me, this branch my master. How do we presume to claim for ourselves or for our children dirt that leaves labor over, or the low hill that is an ancient, broken-hearted mountain worn away by long erosion, white tides of snow? Who owns the rivers unseen that run in the bowels of earth, that lubricate the turning of the axis of the world? Getty? Gulf? Humble? When I was a child, dirt and dry leaves were my first friends. I sat with them, bouncing, talking, before I knew what playing was. I remember the summer day when the lady yelled at me, shoved me from her yard, from her dirt and her dry leaves. Something wrong was done that day, but I thought I had done it. I ran away in my shame with fear that was new, having learned my first lesson in who really owns the earth. You can say the Lord's is the earth if you want to, but let him try to picnic where it's posted. Who owns the earth? Getty? Gulf? Humble? And that mean lady of my early flight and shame? The firmament of stability, the foundation of the universe, the source of all fertility, the womb, the tomb, the green planet. We learn to think of it as property or real estate if it's for sale. If we have awakened to the earth, we may be in trouble because it belongs to someone else. We may use the sidewalk and the street and those scabs of concrete assigned to playing. If we exult in harvest now, we are trespassing. The mean lady this time may have a gun. If we allow the soil to stir our souls, we may be changed. We may learn what we once knew, that the dirt and the dry leaves own us. It was men like you and me who first cried, 'The Lord's is the earth and the fullness thereof.' They were probably trying to say more about each other than about God. To say the land is the Lord's is not to say he is the landlord. The earth and its children know, the old men and women who own nothing, the defeated, the sharecroppers, the starving, the peasants who trespass everywhere. The Lord's is the earth, and it is full enough for everyone. It waits for us to learn again." First of all, I'm glad you're all back. I wondered after yesterday's difficult session whether anybody would come back, and I thought of a poem that I think I learned once from the Reader's Digest. It goes, "By daylight when I wish to awe my friends with my acumen, how wittily I hem and haw, to err is only human. But when at night I lay abed and Morpheus treats me badly, the clever things I should have said come trooping to me gladly." Wait, ah, what a killer I would be, how deucedly attractive if repertoires of repartee were only retroactive. Well, Hans, who was sitting there, I found out that there were all kinds of people who wanted the floor yesterday, and I'll try to look up in the balcony once in a while this morning. Hans pointed out that that one of the problems with what we were talking about yesterday is that that I had originally began, even on Monday, by saying we wanted to observe sort of how Paul the pastoral theologian operates in this situation. And I didn't do that yesterday. That's one of the sort of clever things I left out. But the real question might have been for us, what can we learn from Paul? How can he bring the proclamation of Jesus as the crucified one to bear on even the problem of human sexuality? I had originally sort of designed this topic to be, what does sex have to do with Christian witness? And if we cannot learn answers from Paul, we may at least learn an approach, and that was one of the things I just sort of left out. I thought that maybe one of the ways in which we can at least get started on thinking about a Christian sexual ethic is to note that human sexual activity involves us, in one sense at least, in the ultimate invulnerability. I think the profound insight in the fall story, in creation, is that once Adam and Eve had taken their existence into their own hands and striven for mastery, they could not afford to be vulnerable in front of each other anymore, and they had to cover themselves. The protection was as much from each other as from the elements. They both knew what they were capable now of doing to the other in the name of mastery, and therefore they needed protection. So sexual activity involves us then once again in the uncovering, and therefore in vulnerability. We cannot, however, really afford in a fallen world to be vulnerable, utterly vulnerable to one another, unless there is that quality of commitment to one another, which enables us once more to open ourselves to each other. And that, I think, might be the reason or the beginnings for us to ask ourselves, what really is involved then in the Christian witness that takes place in human sexuality? There were just a couple of other things that Paul suggests. Hans pointed out to me some radical things that I knew were there, and in chapter 7 didn't even look at them. One of them is verses 3 and 4, where Paul radically opens up mutuality in marriage, where it is not only the husband who has the power over the wife, but where the wife too does not rule her own, where the husband does not rule his own body, but the wife does. That's an unheard of thing in the ancient world. And Paul is here using, again, the vulnerability of the gospel as a way of opening these people to a valid sexual ethic. Or 7:16, another place. Wife, how do you know whether you will save your husband? Husband, how do you know whether you will save your wife? Back to verse 15, I'm sorry, 7:15, not 7:16. If the unbelieving partner desires to separate, let it be so. In such case, a brother or sister is not bound, for God has called us to peace. You know, this is in the midst of the commitment that marriage calls for. Paul is actually saying here, it's better to have peace than to have a marriage in which it's impossible for people to be committed to each other. Again, a kind of radical statement. And then 7:22. He who was called in the Lord as a slave is really a freed man in the Lord. Likewise, he who was free when called is a slave of Christ. Reminiscent of Luther's statement on Christian freedom, that is, that the Christian is a free person and subject to no one, and the Christian is a slave subject to everyone. A final comment from yesterday. I was pretty hard on Paul's concern for celibacy, perhaps even his commitment to it. But I thought about this a little bit afterwards too, and it seems to me that marriage becomes not what everybody does, but a genuine calling. That is, that we are really free for the calling to marry only if there is also in the church an equal recognition of the calling to celibacy. And I think that that may well be the thing that Protestants have lost, because we mostly look upon people who are attempting at least the call to celibacy as if there were something wrong with them. What's wrong with you? Why aren't you married yet? But in one sense, at least, Paul is saying that both marriage and celibacy in the New Testament now become not a necessity, but a sign to each other. And therefore, we are free. We have a genuine choice for marriage only at that point where there is a celibate sign among us. I think it's good to recognize that on St. Benedict's Day, when we think of the celibate communities of which Benedict was one of the most important founders, and recognize that as a kind of sign in our midst. The other thing that, the other problem that I tried to deal with yesterday was how difficult it is for us to appreciate today the notion of our solidarity with one another and this whole sense of union that underlies Paul's thought and that is so difficult for us to appreciate. Again, Hans pointed out I have a whole sheet, 2 pages of notes that Hans wrote after the session yesterday. Marvelous response. I'm reading some of his stuff because he's running the seminar today. But he asks, is there some reason why this notion of solidarity is difficult for us? He says, it may be the same reason why we cannot really write tragedy today. Our individualism has prevented us not only from appropriating Paul's notion of solidarity and union, but also prevents us from a genuine appreciation of the tragic unity in which the human race is caught up. But when we watch tragedy that comes from the great ages of tragedy, classical Greece, Renaissance, Reformation, that produced eventually Shakespeare, and the tragic novels that came out of the 19th and early 20th century, when we encounter them, we are touched again by the notion that we really are somehow linked together in a tragic humanity. And therefore can also hear once again the gospel of our being linked together in a redeemed humanity. That's the point for today, this linking of ourselves together as a redeemed humanity, because that's what's involved in Paul's discussion of idolatry, Eucharist, and affluence. I want to read chapter 8. Chapter 10 and the last part of chapter 11. I'm going to save the first part of chapter 11 for tomorrow's discussion of clergy, women clergy, and worker priests. There were two things that were especially singled out by the early Christian community as characteristic of paganism. One of them was idolatry, and the other was sexual conduct. We dealt with Paul's response to the Corinthian situation on sexual conduct yesterday. Today we see him taking up the whole question of idolatry. And it focused not primarily in the temples. It focused primarily in the way in which pagan cultic activity permeated the life of the community, the life of the people. We recognize from the book of Acts, for example, how the goddess Diana influenced and permeated the whole life of the city of Ephesus, so that for someone to come in and call people to a community where there was no idol worship affected the economic life of that city. And the silversmiths, who had a big market in trinkets and jewelry and statues of Diana that were sold to the pilgrims and the tourists who came, raised a hue and cry, and finally had Paul tossed into prison and all kinds of other things. One of the most pervasive aspects of the pagan cultus that affected the whole of life was that meat sold in the butcher shops was first offered, consecrated to the gods. And here again, the interrelationship of religion and a society's culture came to bear. One of the things we have to recognize is that the early Christian proclamation and the early Christian communities were regarded with enormous suspicion by the whole society, by the culture, by the economic and political interests. They were regarded as atheists and unpatriotic by their fellow citizens because they denied the gods, and that affected everybody's pocketbook, and they denied the ultimate commitment of the state, and that affected sort of the security and the power that the state exercised. So they were a persecuted minority. I want to raise some questions today as we look at idolatry and affluence and the Christian Eucharist about the easy connections that we make in our culture today between economics and religion. Now, Paul's concern here is, I think, a very simple one. We know, he says, that these idols have no existence. They do not exist. And therefore, in a sense, whether or not the meat in the butcher shops was offered to the idols really need not affect us. But there are people in the Christian community whose break with the pagan culture around them is a fragile one. And for the sake of these people, he says, we need to be sensitive and watch, in a sense, what we do. I'll just read chapter 8, we can see his concern. Now he says, concerning food offered to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. It seems as if Paul is quoting from the Corinthian letter every once in a while. Someone had probably written to him, we all possess knowledge, and therefore we know that these gods have no existence. Paul goes on, if anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. But if one loves God, one is known by him. It's a terrible word for theologians. Paul is saying, in a sense, it would be better if we weren't experts on religion and spent more time loving people. Hence, to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence, apparently probably quoting again from the position which the Corinthians had taken, and now sort of responding to that. We know there is no God but one. For although there may be many so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, the term Kyrios as a confession of Jesus, which we're going to be dealing with, I think, on Friday, the term Kyrios really put Jesus in competition with all kinds of Kyrioi, all kinds of lords who were populating the ancient world, from the Lord Caesar, or the local lord who represented Caesar, to the lords that were in the Greek and Roman pantheons. Although there are many lords, yet there is for us one God, the Father, from whom are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. Notice how he just puts it to them with that confession, Jesus is Lord. There is only one. All the other lords aren't really lords at all. An astonishing word. However, not all possess this knowledge. Some, through being hitherto accustomed to idols, eat food as if it really were offered to an idol. and their conscience being weak is then defiled. Food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, no better off if we do. It's sort of take it or leave it. Holden is trying to teach us that with its cuisine. We don't need some of the things that we're accustomed to. And so you come here and you find out you can get along without beef seven times a week. Only take care lest this liberty of yours somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. Dave Christian said to me this morning he's always afraid to serve beef because he wonders whether he'll trigger a riot in the dining hall. Take care lest this liberty of yours somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you, a man of knowledge, at table in an idol's temple, might he not be encouraged, if his conscience is weak, to eat food as if it were offered to idols? So by your knowledge this weak man is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. One of C.S. Lewis's most profound comments comes in his little book of sermons on the weight of glory, in which he says that that the way in which we relate to each other means that we are every day dealing with people who have an eternal destiny, and however they may appear to us here, we are looking at people who in their eternal destiny may confront us with a magnificence that cannot be seen in terms of the people whom we encounter here. To think of others as those for whom Christ died, the brothers and the sisters for whom Christ died, is a way of asking ourselves, what am I going to do over against these people? Thus sinning against your brethren, your sisters, and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Jürgen Moltmann told us that there are really two ways in which Jesus promises to be with the apostles. One is that he will be with the community in its proclamation and its witness, but the other way he will be in the world is in those for whom we care. That is where we encounter Jesus. Those who are the agents of his love, he promises to be with, but also those who are the objects of love and care in the world. Therefore, if food is the cause of my brother's falling, I will never eat meat, lest I cause my brother to fall. It's a powerful word. In Corinthians 10, 1 Corinthians 10, Paul goes on with this same concern. He adduces an incident out of the Old Testament that never happened. Again, one of those marvelous little things. There was a story involving a rock. Moses was supposed to have struck the rock and got water from it. Much later, in Jewish tradition, comes the account that this rock sort of followed them as a kind of traveling fountain. When I came to Germany in 1954, the Germans sometimes told how funny it was to watch Russian soldiers who had never seen plumbing at all turn on a faucet, see the water coming out of it, and then unscrew the faucet to take it back to Russia with them in the hope that they would be able to, you know, just plug it into the wall and get water. Well, that's the legend. That's the legend that the Jews had about this sort of instant fountain that just followed them around in the desert. You know, plunk it down and swoosh, out comes the water. Well, Paul quotes that. He says, but the reason why he does is again to talk about the solidarity that people had because they drank the same supernatural drink and ate the same supernatural food. I want to talk about that. I want to point out the significance of this later on when we come to chapter 11 and the Eucharist. The solidarity that came from eating and drinking together. Then he says, with most of them God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Obviously, not all murmured, not all were involved in rebellions, but all suffered, almost like the concentration camps where, to prevent escapes, the Germans or the Japanese would sort of number off people in tens and say, any one of you who escapes, the other nine will be shot. It goes against our whole sense of morality and responsibility today, but Paul is operating with some of that sense of solidarity. These things, he says, were warnings for us not to desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to dance. We must not indulge in immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put the Lord to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. These things happened to them as a warning, for they were written down for our instruction, upon whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, lest anyone who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. Paul begins then his discussion of the Eucharist already here, saying, therefore, my beloved, shun the worship of idols. I speak as to sensible men. Judge for yourselves what I say. Now comes one of those great solidarity passages. The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not a koinonia, he is saying here, in the blood of Christ? I grew up in a staunchly Lutheran catechetical tradition where this passage was always used as a primary evidence of the real presence. We had it right, all the Protestants had it wrong. We were literally sharing in the blood of Christ. But the emphasis is not so much on what's there, but on the solidarity that is taking place. If we, again, my whole catechism tradition was a kind of movement from naivete to disillusionment, because as I grew up and began to look up these passages that had been quoted in the catechism, I found out how many of them had been taken out of context, how they didn't really, quote, prove the things they were supposed to prove, and how instead they were saying something quite other than that. Far from being primarily a testimony to what is there eaten, although it's also that, it is primarily a testimony to our solidarity as we eat together. Again, the contrast couldn't be more clear. In the pagan culture, those who ate of the meat sacrificed to idols were, as Paul says later, partners with demons, verse 20. If you eat the body and blood of Jesus, you are a partner with him. Implications in a moment. Just note the emphasis. The bread which we break, is it not a sharing, a koinonia, a participation in the body of Christ? Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. Consider the practice of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices partners in the altar? What do I imply then? That food offered to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, I imply that what pagans sacrifice they offer to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to be partners with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Then he comes back to the all things are lawful, but we got to take care of the neighbor. And verse 26, the earth is the Lord's, everything in it. If one of the unbelievers invites you to dinner and you are disposed to go, eat whatever is set before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience. But if someone says to you, this has been offered in sacrifice, then out of consideration for the man who informed you, as a form of witness, in effect, I mean his conscience, not yours, do not eat it. For why should my liberty be determined by another man's scruples? If I partake with thankfulness, why am I denounced because of that for which I give thanks? So, whether you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense to Jews or Greeks, or to the church of God, just as I try to please all men in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, that they may be saved. Be imitators of me as I am of Christ. And then we're going to skip now to verse 17 of 1 Corinthians 11, the section on the Eucharist. Before I go there, I just want to raise a question. We don't have today altars to Apollos or Venus or Diana or Zeus or Jupiter or Juno to which meat is sacrificed. It's a good question to ask. Do we have anything similar today? But if we understand, I think, the relationship between economics and worship, then we might well ask ourselves what form Christian witness takes in the kind of eating practices that we have. I have often thought that maybe the meat sacrificed to idols today gets done at McDonald's. And no, literally, their advertising slogan, at least as nearly as I can remember it, is, "We do it all for you." Well, I wonder if that's the one for whom everything ought to be done. I have already long since thought of advertising when I think of the renunciation of the devil and his empty promises in the baptismal liturgy. But especially as I discovered that McDonald's prepares great quantities of food and discards the hamburgers that aren't eaten within 10 minutes. That was the point at which I began to wonder whether it isn't indeed a part of our witness and our solidarity with the people who do not have enough bread and enough food in the world, that we really ask serious questions about where we eat and under what circumstances we eat. Eating ought to be more sacramental than it is for us. It ought to be done with greater care. It ought to be done with more consideration frequently than in these fast food experiences. I just thought about a couple of things that might help us. Robert Capon, I quoted him Monday, the guy who wrote Hunting the Divine Fox, this Lassie as Messiah, is also a gourmet cook. Gourmet has visions for us of expensive four-star restaurants in France, but it needn't have that. And he's written a couple of books on reverence and eating. One is called The Supper of the Lamb, full of recipes and theology. And the other is called Bed and Board. I think we even have some in the bookstore. You might just take a look at them. They're delightful books. He's a funny man. But he talks about care in preparing food and how to drink wine, not for the sake of getting drunk, but for the sake of enhancing the quality of the food that we eat. I also think of my own boyhood, where certain foods and certain days went together, and how we didn't feast every day of our lives. We're trying to do a little of that at Holden now. Sundays is really a feast day. It's the day of Eucharist. It's also the day when we eat well. But to balance that, I don't mean we have days when we don't eat well, but we don't eat as substantially as we do on Sunday. Saturdays is a kind of salad day. I remember from my boyhood that on Saturdays it was always sort of soup day in the family. And my mother would make us a good soup that day, and that was our food for Saturday. Sunday was the only day we had breakfast rolls, because Saturday was also baking day. And so on Sundays, then, the treat was a breakfast roll. There were many meatless days when I was growing up as a boy in the Depression, and didn't seem to stunt my growth very much. So it seems to me that maybe one of the things we ought to ask ourselves in our own culture today is how our own eating can be a way of bearing witness to the character of Jesus as the one crucified for us. And that comes to special attention in the chapter on the Eucharist. In the following instructions, verse 17, I do not commend you, because when you come together, it is not for the better, but for the worse. Notice just the little phrase here, come together. Last night, Jim Fish read us from Bonhoeffer's beautiful book, The Life Together, in which Bonhoeffer comments on the fact that the experience that we have here, or at seminary perhaps, or at a college where there is daily worship, that kind of experience of Christians who are able to live together in community is really a rare privilege. It's the exception. It is not the rule. The rule is that we are mostly scattered like seed out there in the world, and that we must make an effort to come together and to be together. I stopped to visit a friend in California once when we were coming out west for a summer at Holden, and I asked him after we had had lunch together, can I see your church? And he said, oh, no, we haven't got time. I said, what's the matter? We've got all afternoon. He said, but they're all over. He was not going to take me to a building. He knew where his church was in the middle of the week. It was out there all over the city. And we really didn't have time to see his church. They came together in order to be the Christian community. Now, Paul is saying, when you come together, good things aren't happening. I told you on Monday that the makeup of the Christian community was a few probably reasonably affluent people in the community, but most slaves, lower classes, poor people, perhaps freedmen who had saved every last nickel and dime they could scrape together to buy their freedom and now had nothing much to go on. When they came together then, the more affluent apparently brought a lot of food for their common meal and also for their celebration, for their Eucharist. But they got tired of doing that, and especially they got tired of welfare chiselers. And so they passed their Proposition 13 and stopped eating, sharing their food with their fellows. They had been hurt, and so they withdrew. I have a marvelous book here by C. Fitzsimmons Allison called Fear, Love, and Worship. And one of his chapters begins with the fear of caring. Just want to read a section. Life quickly teaches us that caring causes hurt. So the most easily understood of all fears is perhaps the fear of caring. Each of us has only to consider the occasions of hurt to realize that it was our caring that made us vulnerable. Perhaps one occasion was someone's death. We read every day of people being killed, but since we do not know or deeply care about them, we feel no pain. When someone dies whom we know and love, then we are hurt quite poignantly. And in fact, our hurt would seem is in direct proportion to our caring. In this chapter, he says, we must consider how and why we are afraid to care and how worship becomes the means of the love that casts out this fear. One other paragraph out of this delightful book. Mary Chase, in her play Harvey, describes Elwood Dodd, a remarkably attractive character who can walk into a bar, sit down with his drink in a booth, and people flock to him as nails to a magnet. They see in his face some quality of fresh awareness and sense in his countenance real questions. They come over, sit down, and tell him of all the bad things they have done and the great good things they are going to do, and then Elwood introduces them to Harvey. Harvey, who sits next to Elwood, is a 7-foot-tall rabbit whom no one can see. In these times, one does not talk with imaginary rabbits without eventually talking to a psychiatrist. So Elwood is taken to a psychiatrist who tells him, if you'll begin by taking a cooperative attitude, that's half the battle. We all have to face reality, Dowd, sooner or later. To this, Elwood replies, I've wrestled with reality for 40 years, doctor, and I'm happy to state that I finally won out over it. My mother used to say to me, in this world, Elwood, you must be oh so smart or oh so pleasant. For 40 years I was smart. I recommend pleasant. You may quote me. Okay, Paul is talking now about people who had been bringing the food and got smart. They saw that there were some people who were just using this as an occasion to be freeloaders. And they got smart at that point, and they said, well, by George, we're not going to share our food anymore. I had one experience of this in the Lower East Side of New York City. Jan and I went for a weekend to New York, and we went to a church on the Lower East Side where Art Simon, who's now head of Bread for the World, was the pastor. And the congregation met in the basement. They couldn't afford to heat the big upstairs part of the church anymore. It was a black and Latin-speaking and white congregation, but a fairly small group. And we sat in a big circle for the Eucharist, and they passed the loaf of bread and the big cup of wine, and all of a sudden it came to a man who ripped off just a great big chunk of bread and started stuffing it into his mouth. When the chalice came, he drained it and held it out for more and drained it again. Afterwards, I said to Art, who was that? He said, I don't know, never saw him before in my life. It was undoubtedly somebody who had come in and was using this literally as his breakfast. And there was a time when I would have been shocked by that, you know, desecration of the real presence. But I thought, after I began to read Corinthians, that maybe that's partly what they were experiencing, you see. People coming in and eating their maybe one decent meal of the week at this gathering of the community. But look at what happens. First of all, Paul says there were divisions. And then in verse 20, when you meet together, it's not the Lord's Supper that you eat. They could do it ritually correctly, but if they weren't sharing, it wasn't the Lord's Supper. For in eating, he says, each one goes ahead with his own meal. One is hungry and another drunk. What? Don't you have houses to eat and drink in? In other words, you might as well stay home if that's what you're going to do. You are certainly not coming together to be the church. If you don't want to be had, if you don't want to be taken, then you might as well stay home. Then you're just like everybody else. Then you are not the church at all. Do you despise the church of God, he says, and humiliate those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I commend you in this? No, I will not. And now notice what Paul does. He recalls for them the tradition. Scholars are telling us that this formula that he introduces it with, I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, is a standard formula for introducing pre-shaped traditional materials. You got to think of the bucket brigade here. I handed on what I received from the Lord, I handed on to you. This liturgical formula may, scholars tell us, go back to within months or at most a couple of years of the original supper setting in which Jesus did this. When Paul wants to reform the church, he tells a story in the form of the tradition. Every Eucharist that we celebrate is this kind of ritual storytelling once again to recall us to the character of our being in the world. And how does he tell the story? That the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way also the cup after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat the bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." In other words, what we are doing in this meal is being involved in the sacrifice of Christ for the world. And the way we are involved in it is not to say, oh, here's some good stuff for me and only me up there on the altar. I had been taught again that communion was really my private little tete-a-tete with God. That's a heresy. It really is a heresy. The favorite song of millions of Protestants is, "He walks with me and he talks with me and he tells me I am his own, and the joy we share as we tarry there, none other has ever known." That's a terrible song. It really is terrible. It has nothing to do with Jesus and his way of being in the world through a community. He is not, in religion, Christianity is not me and Jesus. Christianity is Jesus for us and us for the world. That's what Paul is trying to say here. When we come together for Eucharist, we are coming together for a radical experience. That kind of ritual storytelling, that kind of ritual sharing in Jesus. That kind of ritual storytelling, that kind of ritual sharing in Jesus, which helps us to proclaim the Lord's death for the world by our caring for one another and for the world. That's what he was up to. That's what we are called to be up to. Therefore, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of profaning the body and blood of the Lord. What damage that passage has done to Christian being in the world. I used to be terrified, so terrified of the Lord's Supper that I would get psychosomatically ill before communion, that I might be eating and drinking damnation to myself if I wasn't thinking only of me and Jesus and all penitence and everything else. Gertrude Lansing was a venerable matron in my second parish. She was arthritic and had to haul herself up three steps to get to the altar. I smiled at her once to encourage her. I've never been so creamed out at the door by anybody. She thought that if I made her laugh, she says, I resisted you today, you know, I didn't laugh. But if I had laughed, do you realize I would have eaten and drunk to my damnation? Oh, that is the last thing I wanted to do to Gertrude Lansing. See, but that's what we have been taught, I think, or at least that's what I was taught. So, you know, you dress in black and you put on blinkers and, oh, it was terrible when I was a teenager to wonder whether or not I was drinking unworthily. Let a man examine himself and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. No, what Paul is saying here is pay attention to the story of what's going on here so that when you eat and drink, you will be proclaiming Christ for the world in the being of the body. For one who eats and drinks without discerning the body, that is, without caring for the people who need our care, is eating and drinking judgment upon himself. That is why many of you are weak and ill and some have died. But if we judged ourselves truly, we would not be judged. But when we are judged by the Lord, we are chastened so that we may not be condemned along with the world. You know, Proposition 13 is what the world does. Caring for one another, even if we're being had, is what we do. I don't know if I have time. Somebody asked a couple of days ago in some session or other, I think it was maybe Hans, asked in his session when he was reading this marvelous little short story by Alan Payton, whether we had ever involved ourselves with people in prisons. I did. Jan and I signed up for a Man for Man program, and we were put in touch with a prisoner who hadn't been getting any mail from anybody, and we visited him and wrote letters and sent some packages during the last 6 months before his parole, and then helped him get a job after he got out and bought him some clothes at Sears. After a couple of weeks, I lent him $250 to buy a car, and he paid it all back, $25 a week over a 10-week period, But the car wasn't any good. What can you get for $250? And it was a question of a great big transmission job on that car or a better car. We opted for a better car. I thought by now, you know, that it wouldn't be any problem at all to get a loan with the car as collateral. So we went to Household Finance, but they insisted after they checked up that I co-sign the note. No problem, I co-signed the note. We got the car, and he was starting to pay back the loan, except that the car threw a rod or something or other. It was also a used car, was no good. As a result of trying to fix the car, he lost his job, wasn't able to make the payments, and pretty soon Household Finance was sitting on my doorstep. Then I discovered that he didn't make the insurance payments on the car. He didn't have any money, and he really wasn't able to get credit. I went to a lawyer then, our friend who's a lawyer, who said, stupid idiot, you know, never sign anything like this. Before it was all over, it cost us, I guess, about $2,000 to buy off Household Finance and get the papers all squared away so that he had the car. And that was my experience with vulnerability. It was a way of being had. I guess I still have somehow some ambivalent feelings about that. But I learned a lot about the difficulties that people have in coming out of prison and the impossibility for them to get credit and how almost impossible it is for us to function in our society today without automobiles, without credit, without jobs. Ex-convicts have no recourse to all of the things that I at least take for granted. Well, anyway, my temptation is, again, to back off from that sort of thing, to say, boy, I've been hurt once. I don't know whether I may not have given in to that. Anyway, Paul concludes, so then, my brothers and sisters, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. If one is hungry, let him eat at home, lest you come together to be condemned. About other things, I will give directions when I come. Well, I think this is a rich section for us. It calls on us literally to ask, what are we doing when we come together for Eucharist? Are we literally wanting to be reshaped once again to be Christ's body for the world? It's partly what our liturgy is, the work of the people, gathering to eat and drink the body of Christ so that we can become the body. I think of this whenever I look at those final words, beautiful in the current SBH, go in peace, serve the Lord, and if you have caught the vision, you say, thanks be to God, and beat it out of there to be the church. No hanging around. Handshaking ought to occur before you arrive or when you arrive, before the liturgy begins. When it's over, it's thanks be to God and out. Our organist now in our parish in Columbus doesn't even play a postalude anymore. We don't want any lingering around. We come from the table to the world. That's what happens if we understand Eucharist. It means putting whatever affluence we have into the service of that world that can take advantage of us. And that's all right. Christ did not ask how much good his death was going to do. He only asked to be doing the will of the Father. And if we are shaped by that death, that is what we will be asking as well. I expect Jan Hansen and Paul Wee and Hans Spalteholz and everybody else who's here in the village to spell out the implications of that as we think about second world, third world, economics, today poverty at 10:30 and taxes. Tough stuff. I think Paul lays the groundwork for that here. We have 5 minutes. Didn't leave you much time for rebuttal today. Please.
Question about infant communion. Is it possible then that, because because I'm with you about a communion always was the bread and the wine. I think I was at least an adult before I realized communion meant this.
Yeah.
And does that say something then, or does this passage say something then to the question of infant communion for you?
I suppose maybe everybody, at least all the parishes of ALC and LCA, have gotten the statement on communion practices that the two church bodies hammered out. It's a compromise statement between traditional Lutheran piety, which says, sort of, you know, me and Jesus, and some biblical piety, which doesn't have that kind of focus at all. At least I can't find it in the New Testament. I think that that comment at the very end, therefore this precludes the communing of infants, really doesn't follow from the whole argument. And I think that, as in many instances, we are maybe a half a generation away from some serious rethinking. I hope that that statement will now lead us to ask again, what's going on when we celebrate? If we baptize infants, it's hard for me to imagine that we can't also include them in the community's way of being in the world at whatever level they are able to participate. We certainly include the sick in the meal of solidarity. A story on that. I spent a weekend at First Lutheran in Albert Lea a couple of years ago, and they have little packages of bread and wine, which they place on the altar in a big basket at the 9:30 Eucharist. And then they have names on these, about 100 names, and 100 members of the congregation, when the Eucharist ends, take these named packages to the sick right the very day that the congregation celebrates Eucharist. And they have discovered that that ministry, you see, of lay people, 100 lay people fanning out after the 9:30 Eucharist, led to all kinds of other caring, shopping for the elderly and the shut-ins, visiting on days when they weren't bringing Eucharist to sit and read with them a while, or just to share with them. It's just been a marvelous ministry that Eucharist led to that kind of solidarity, you see. Now, nobody is expecting many of these sick people to be greatly active in the mission of the church, but they are participating in Eucharist at the level at which they are able to participate. Why not, you see, also then our children? It might be better if we spoke of it as family communion rather than as infants communing. But I think if we, what we really have to do is rethink what's going on here. Are we a body? And does that body have infant members, old members, infirm members, sick members, weak members, or at least weak in some things while others are strong in others, or some, the same people strong in one thing, weak in another thing? Do we need each other? Does that all come to expression as we eat and drink together? Now, I read Paul and I'm saying that's what it's all about. Difficult for me to see some of this more customary Lutheran piety in what he's talking about. But nothing other than a wreath, if we say, can they examine themselves? No, they can't. Do they recognize Christ's body and blood in the bread and wine? Well, no, they don't. I mean, they don't even recognize their mothers and fathers yet. But I say, you know, is that the point? Or is the point that they share with us in Christ's way of being in the world at whatever level they're able to? Well, I don't want to be suspended from I don't do it, so maybe I'm safe. I just talk about it. Yes.
Just one quick comment. I just so appreciate the fact that the community that you emphasize today, how this lies in the face of so much of the privatistic religious presentation you have over the electronic devices, the radio and television.
Yeah.
That's just the opposite to what you're talking about. It's a very obvious thing.
Yeah, I worry about electronic heresy as a substitute for our coming together, you know, and how many people are saying, oh, I can get it from Robert Schuller, and that's a lot better than I can get down at local, at the local St. Aloysius's. And it's true. Again, if you read C.S. Lewis, if you read, what is it, Screwtape Letters, where his new convert goes to church for the first time and sees who's actually there, and it's not very impressive. and then, of course, the temptation is to say, this is the church, you know. Well, of course. I cannot put on a religious show like Billy Graham. I just can't on Sunday morning. I haven't got Cliff Barrows and George Beverly Shea to sing solos, and you know, I haven't got a 1,000 voice choir and all this stuff. I just don't, you know. We are what we are. I had Mrs. Fenske playing the organ, and we were lucky to get through the hymns. I mean, the liturgy. She could manage. It was the same every Sunday. It was these different hymns that were the problem, you know. But see, that is the reality, you know. That is when we finally discover that we come together with whatever we are and become the body of Christ for the world. Broken, inadequate, weak. That's what all this stuff was about, you know, the sacrificing to idols. But the main thing is, come together. Okay.
You're talking about going from church and serving. Black African missionary came to our church, and he said that after church, they were supposed to visit all the people that didn't come to church. And so a lot of people came to church just so they wouldn't get
in. Well, not bad. You know, one of the things that impresses me about the Corinthian congregation, too, again, is that literally they came together to do business with each other. And it's when they stop doing that that Paul says, you're not coming together to be the church. I wonder what it would be like, you see, if we really said, when we gather now on Sunday morning, it may take a little longer than the 60 minutes that we're accustomed to, because we have really come to do business with each other. I think, what would it be like if we had our parish announcements, if we had maybe parish business meetings somewhere in the context of that liturgy, if we had the entrance rite with coffee and a hymn and prayers and handshaking and greetings and so on, and then before the service of the word, there's a little rubric in SBH that says, now come parish notices and the occasion for the day. And then we would stop to literally do whatever business we had to do as a community, then go on with the service of the word, and then at the peace we would welcome new members or congratulate people or whatever, and then go on with a meal and out. I think it would be a kind of marvelous experience of the gathering of the community. But I have little sense of that most of the time when the church gathers. We sort of do the liturgy and make sure that not much else happens, and then people say, well, we've had our religious fix for the week, and home we go. Misses the point.
That the coffee hour that now comes between the services, which is a sort of a voluntary meeting within the meeting kind of a thing, you know, belongs to some or not to others, or if you're not too comfortable or whatever, that would all be...
That would be part of the entrance rite, yes. Right. I would just say coffee and a hymn and a greeting, and everybody greets everybody, and then we get ready to do business, and then comes the service of the word. And, you know, I think it would be marvelous. We might even break up adults and children after the reading of the lessons to experience them differently. Oh, marvelous. Whole new vision. The bell is going to ring. It's 10 of. thank you. It's been a marvelous session. Tomorrow.